Vision of Workforce Development for another beautiful day in the month of May. Hopefully, it will be this way all week long. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2096. Janet.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 2096 is at the request of the Housing and Community Services Department, and it would authorize the formation of nonprofit manufactured dwelling park cooperatives and make them eligible for existing housing loan and technical assistance programs. Specifies that membership in the cooperatives is limited to homeowners who do or will occupy a home in the park when they purchase a membership. It prohibits members from selling memberships for more than the amount they paid for the membership, adjusted for the cost of living increases. It authorizes the Housing and Community Services Department to provide second lien loans to provide for gap financing, and it increases the percent, the level of a percentage of a loan that may be guaranteed by the department's guarantee fund. It specifies that eligibility for program loans would be based on a significant percentage, but not necessarily all, of residents meeting low income thresholds, and it provides consistent income eligibility restrictions throughout the housing statutes. And one other change it makes is a revision in the definition of elderly from 58 to 55, and this is in compliance with the federal fair housing law. So if the bill passes, I would become elderly, and I'm not elderly now.
Thank you for pointing that out. We all knew that.
And then there are,
and we have two amendments, I see.
Yes, the dash one amendments are the ones that from the agency, a technical amendment that would maintain eligibility for a current program that was inadvertently changed by the original bill. And I want to point out there is no fiscal or revenue impact to the bill.
Okay, and then hopefully Mr. Van Nottingham will talk to us at the dash two. Let's ask Lynn, John, and Rick to come forward. Call this manufactured housing redo.
In my entire life.
We have written testimony to put in the file, too, so... Speak to us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Chesler. I'm the Housing Finance Section Manager for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And this bill was developed with our community partners to further the preservation of manufactured dwelling parks throughout the state. The committee administrator has done an excellent job of summarizing. I think many of you are familiar with the issue of manufactured dwelling parks in your community, and the loss of them is a predictable trend that seems to be increasing. So we've tried to create the co-op portion of this bill to create a less expensive and less disruptive approach to keeping affordable housing available, rather than relocating families and incurring the expense of high-cost replacement affordable housing. The significant provision of the bill is to create an opportunity in Oregon for park residents to own their park using the proven successful model, that being the Manufactured Dwelling Park Nonprofit Cooperative, a name way too long, but we couldn't think of a shorter one, so that's what we have. This co-op is designed to provide a stable living situation for residents over the long term and ensures that the public investment in this model is retained and not lost upon a possible sale of that co-op at a later date. And I've asked John Van Landingham to give us some greater detail about the park co-op model. The other portion of this bill, or the balance of the 14 pages, enable our existing resources to be more effectively used in park preservation. Our department statutes cover two chapters, ORS 456 and 458, and you'll see references to both those chapters throughout the bill. Just let me recap, maybe in a little bit more detail, the summary that Janet provided. Bill first allows the department to provide gap financing loans. With this ability, the department will be better able to partner with private lenders in providing supportive financing that residents of co-ops or park purchase associations might need to preserve their park. And that, as Janet referenced, is the ability to provide secondary loans or loans in second positions for the park resident purchase as a portion of the price. The bill also expands the depth of our existing loan guarantee. Under the bill, the department would be able to make loan guarantees of up to 50% of the principal balance instead of the current 25% limit. And we view that as an opportunity to provide more assurance to private lenders who might not otherwise participate in the park purchase, the guarantee being a greater assurance to them than they currently are able to derive. Another change in House Bill 2096 allows the department to assist parks with a significant percentage of lower-income households rather than requiring all residents to meet the income households. And in doing that, we're trying to avoid the circumstance where a resident of a park might incur an inheritance. We've created some sort of affordability in that park, and due to the inheritance, they may have an income in excess of what the original income requirements are. Because the resident owns their unit, we don't want to see them forced to move just because of a slight influx or increase in wealth. So we're trying to make it flexible so that they can remain there and continue to realize the benefit of our assistance. There are also several housekeeping changes that update the statutes currently in federal definitions. The bill updates the definition of elderly to match the federal fair housing law. Oregon's current statute precedes the federal statute and presents a conflict in our ability to finance parks due to the mismatch of elderly being defined as 55 by federal law, but 58 under state law. The bill also clarifies the definition of low, very low, and lower income as it relates to our programs. Again, the state definitions preceded federal definition, and we want to make sure that our practices are consistent. You'll see throughout several pages the term manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperative, and that is inserted to make clear within the statutes that each or that such entity is eligible to participate in our department programs. Last, several existing statutes were relocated and regrouped by legislative council for their view of better organization. You also have before you the Dash 1 amendments for this bill. And frankly, we were so effective in updating our program definitions that the Attorney General identified that we had eliminated the crucial definition that we need to run our first-time homebuyer loan program. So we're asking that the Dash 1s be adopted so that we can, again, continue our homebuyer program and our loan program that's been very successful statewide. The bill does not provide any new resources for preserving manufactured dwellings, but it does provide additional flexibility in the limited resources that we do have. And we are trying with the co-op statute language to provide a new program that will follow the best practices of other states when it comes to manufactured park preservation. These statutory changes are a positive step, we believe, and they do, as Janet indicated, incur no fiscal impact. And that concludes my testimony, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
All right. We'll go to Mr. Van Eyningham first, and then also, are you able to comment on the Dash 2, John?
I will.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Eyningham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I'm here on behalf of the Housing Alliance to urge your support for House Bill 2096. I won't go through great detail. It's probably more the concept is simpler than the execution, although I bear responsibility. I wrote most of the MDP-NP co-op provisions here on the first three pages. What we're trying to do is replicate what New Hampshire is doing. And they're changing the world in terms of mobile home park ownership. And they're trying to sell it or take it to other states. I think we're probably the first or the leading state in trying to replicate what they're doing. In 25 years, they have helped residents buy almost 80 parks. There are several significant benefits to resident ownership of the park. One, you're preserving it as a park, so you don't have the risk of it flipping and being converted to some other use. That's one of the reasons why it has to be a nonprofit cooperative. And I guess I should say here now, in Oregon law, you can be a for-profit corporation, a nonprofit corporation, a cooperative corporation, but you can't be any two of those. So under Oregon law, without this bill, you could not be a nonprofit cooperative. You can be a nonprofit, you can be a cooperative, but you couldn't be both. We want the benefits of cooperative ownership to replicate what New Hampshire is doing, and this is modeled after the New Hampshire law, because cooperative ownership does two major things, or three major things, preserves it as a park, helps the residents have control over their land. And if they own the land, banks treat them as real estate. Right now, if you finance a manufactured home, you finance it as personal property, like your automobile. So the interest rate is significantly higher than if you finance your home that you own. So in New Hampshire, their experience is they're actually able to refinance homes at a much lower rate, use the money to reduce their costs or to rehab their homes or to buy new homes. So it's a great benefit. We think it's one of those rare win-win deals where we'll buy parks from willing sellers. Peter, who's in the audience, will provide technical assistance to help the residents form a co-op and buy the park. So that's what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. The Dash 2. I didn't come prepared to talk about it, so I'm not sure how good my comments will be.
Well, then who's asking for the Dash 2?
I'm drafting, Mr. Chair.
Oh, well, there we go. So why don't you comment on it, and then maybe Senator Starr can tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want me to describe it, or do you want to describe it?
You're the
go
expert.
Ahead. Okay.
I'm fine.
So, what the Dash 2s would do, roughly speaking, would be to allow new mobile home parks, manufactured housing parks, to be developed outside of urban growth boundaries, regardless of existing land use laws. It's a pretty simple. There's not a whole lot of language there. They already allow uses inside UGBs, so that part of it is not a significant, not any change at all. The significant change would be to say that counties would have to allow new mobile home parks outside of UGBs. I think I might have mentioned this committee before, but there are two bills already that do something similar, though don't go this far. One is Don Miner's bill, Senate Bill 765, that was introduced by Senator Morissette. I'm sure you know Don, but he's did that on behalf of the manufacturers of manufactured homes, so they want to promote more manufactured home living. His bill is somewhat similar to Senator Starr's concept. LCDC, of which I'm the chair, and DLCD submitted a bill, Senate Bill 187, which would have allowed cities, or which would allow cities, to expand their urban growth boundaries on an expedited, easier method for the purposes of affordable housing, including new manufactured home parks. So the LCDC concept was would add land to the UGBs because we would make it a condition of the adding. We could control the cost of the land. Otherwise, if you add land to a UGB, you're not controlling the cost.
What's the status, Mr. Chair?
Both bills had a hearing. Both bills did not move. Both bills were told by the chair, Senator Bakken, that they're not going to move.
Okay.
That's the short answer. They did not get out before April 30th, and Senator Bakken has been very clear all along that he didn't intend to move them. He wanted to wait and see what happens with the big look, et cetera. So my fear would be that while I'm obviously supportive of a variation of this idea, that this idea probably is going to generate significant opposition, as did the other bills, from farmers, land use advocates, cities, and counties. And if added to HB 296, I would expect 296 not to pass.
Thank you. Before we ask your questions, would you like to?
Mr. Chair, John Fletcher with Oregon Housing Community Services. And
you didn't sign up, John.
I'm sorry. Just quickly, I would like to say that the changes we're making in House Bill 2096 are not all of the changes that will be needed to help parks, but they take us a long ways in allowing us to use our existing resources in better ways to help parks. It doesn't add any new resources, but it does help us do more with what we have. And with respect to the Dash 2s, again, there's some advantages for manufactured parks that come with the Dash 2s, but as John mentioned, we're concerned too that the controversy that may result may stop the passage of the rest of the bill, which we desperately need. So we hope that you can consider all those factors and do the right thing, whatever that right thing is. But we appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill today and urge your support of House Bill 2096.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'll go to questions.
Sure.
Senator George.
I guess a question. One of the ways that we deal with some of these issues is, like, for instance, destination resorts. We've kicked it to LCDC to write rules on where those can be sited out in rural areas. I have a number of mobile home parks in rural areas in my district that were predated whatever the rules were that prohibit them, and they don't conflict. They tend to be low-density, lower-income people, so they don't have the conflicts with agriculture. In fact, many of them work in the agriculture in the nearby agriculture. So it actually serves dual purpose. It provides a low-cost housing alternative for farm workers or people in the agricultural industry, and they don't have anywhere near the conflicts. And I was wondering, it seems like to me that the Senator Starr's amendments would be compatible, or even maybe if we made it a conditional use rather than outright permitted use, LCDC could write some rules that would sort of draw some boundaries on that.
Senator Metzger, Senator George, I think you're right. I think that LCDC, and I should emphasize that neither LCDC nor DLCD has discussed the Dash 2 concept. We discussed 187, what is 187, which is a much less big change. LCDC could write rules to put parameters on it. It would need statutory authority because right now statutes would prohibit this concept.
I don't have any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Let's ask Peter Hanley, is it? Come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm director of CASA of Oregon, based in Newburgh. And CASA is a 501c3 that develops housing for low-income populations and farm workers throughout the state. And CASA is currently in support of House Bill 2096, exclusive of the current amendments. We just looked at those today, so amendment number 1-1, certainly we're supportive. We've been awarded a grant from a national nonprofit as well as a matching grant from the State Housing and Community Services Department to set up a program whereby residents can purchase their manufactured housing parks. And the part we're looking at trying to do one or two parks over the next year, and we've currently identified about five parks and are negotiating with the sellers. As John had mentioned, we're trying to base this on the successful New Hampshire model, which has converted about 30% of the state's parks into a cooperative ownership form. And so we're working with the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund. They're providing technical assistance to us to assist us in developing our model. We're also working with a number of other organizations to work through some of the legal ownership, taxation issues, assessment issues, et cetera, and financing to try and put this together. We understand what the difficulties are that the residents are facing, and our main charge is really to develop a method by which we can organize them into a legal structure so that they can own and operate this. And so for us, the biggest issue is going to be getting the folks together and working together in some sort of legal structure. So we would encourage you to pass this bill to help out the low income, the seniors, and the disabled folks that are living in these parks. Thank you very much.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can we ask Mr. Van Linden him back? I just thought of a question.
Any questions for Peter?
No.
All right. So John's coming back up. Mr. Bennett, you want to come forward too? Mr. Fletcher took your seat when I called you up before, so I'm going to let you come back up now. But we'll start with Senator Starr's question.
Thank you. Thanks for coming back. I recognize we have a big problem with these manufactured home parks. Obviously, the land upon which they're sitting is increased in value significantly to the point that the property owners, you know, made this or faced with a very difficult choice. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's easy mm-hmm. for these property owners to do mm-hmm. what they're doing. I mean, you got hundreds of families that are displaced ultimately. The question I have is, do we have any manufactured housing parks that are located outside of urban growth boundaries one, does the land use process allow for that land to be transferred or used to be moved from a park to single-family homes?
Different use.
Yeah.
Where's Randy? Do you know that? Can I get him to come join me? So Bob Rennie from the Department of Housing and Development. I would, Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, I would say, and my answer would be that I think that that Senator George is correct there, and you're probably aware there are some older parks outside of urban growth boundaries.
Right.
I don't know how they're zoned. The question would be how they're planned and zoned, and whether they're planned and zoned for residential use, and so could be redeveloped as high-end residential, for example, as a subdivision. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I just now saw the Dash 2s for the first time. Currently, any manufactured housing park that's already outside of UGB most likely has what's called an exception to the farm and forest zones. That exception generally requires that the local government zone it for the use that's there. So they're zoned residential. They might even be zoned for residential manufactured home park, which is a higher density use, but certainly residential. And as such, yes, those areas could be redeveloped with a different park.
Or if I could add, my guess would be that they're zoned residential.
So they could be redeveloped into
as residential, as a different residential use, which is what happens inside of UGB as well.
Then the next question I have is, is there any example throughout the state of Oregon of a manufactured housing park that's located outside of a Minerva growth boundary that has been sold or is in the process of redeveloping?
Getting blank stares that we just don't know.
I think the answer is probably no, because the land within the overgrowth boundary is the land that's ultra valuable.
Senator Mesker, you're absolutely right. That's where the pressure is coming. You mentioned how difficult it is for some park owners to sell. They're getting buckets of money offered to them, and it's for land that's easily developable. And a good example that got a lot of press in Oregonian was the park in West Lynn, where the owner claimed that he thought he could get $10 million for 10 acres. Just cold call from a developer. So if you're outside the UGB and it's not so clear that you can develop at those densities and provide utilities, it's probably not the same economic pressure.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate you coming back, Mr. Manuel.
Thanks, Senator. Mr. Bennett, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP, Oregon. Senator Starr is absolutely right. I've dealt with this issue in Southern Nevada as well. And when you see rapidly appreciating land values and so forth, obviously a park owner once at some point decides they want to take advantage of the appreciation and take that money and perhaps invest it in some other fashion. And you know, that balancing the rights of the property owner to do that with the needs and concerns of the residents, because indeed we're obviously not necessarily talking about homes that are mobile. They are costly to relocate if you can find someplace to relocate them to. So the residents are, when faced with a park closure, are facing rather either a very costly move or abandoning perhaps their only asset. And not only losing that asset, but also losing their friends and community as well. For that reason, that's why AARP supports House Bill 2096. It does provide, it's not the total solution to the problem, but it does provide another option for residents to consider when they're faced with this type of a situation. I'd make a comment related to the Dash 2 amendments, and I have no expertise. Mr. Van Landingham has explained the technical aspects of it and so forth. Mine is more based on the observations of the legislative process over the last 15, 16 years, and understanding that, and particularly working with another legislature that has time limits and deadlines and so forth, and many times when you're dealing with that type of process, bills don't make it through the first deadline. Individuals are looking for opportunities to amend their language to other bills that are still moving forward. And it's one thing when that's more of a friendly amendment. It's my understanding that the language in the Dash 2s has run into some problems in other bills. And I would be very concerned about attaching it to 2096 when this bill has very good support and seems to be moving forward. And I just hate to see this bill run into some problems at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Any questions? Senator George.
Thank you. I guess in dealing with the Dash 2s, and the AARP has to be concerned about seniors who are renters. Any senior who's a renter right now is facing exactly the same thing, whether they're in a mobile home park, apartment complex, whatever. It seems like Senator Starr is trying to set up a situation where we can provide some limited opportunities for lower-income people in lands that probably would provide very few conflicts. It seems like to me if we had the muscle of the ARP and some of the other folks who have said there may be problems, if all of us got together, we could provide opportunity for low-income folks out in rural areas, especially if we granted some authority to LCDC to draft some rules, put some sideboards on it. It seems like to me that that would be a very big concern to your organization, and I was wondering if there's a way that you would support something similar to the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I appreciated not only those comments, but your previous comments as well. And, again, I don't feel I necessarily have the expertise, but I'm certainly willing to talk to others who are involved in that to see if the concerns that have been voiced apparently on other pieces of legislation can be resolved. But, again, if that's the case, yes, certainly be able to try and move it forward. Again, my only concern is that the problems or concerns related to this language can't be resolved, and I'd hate to see that bogged down 2096.
A quick follow-up,
mm-hmm.
Just more of a comment. I guess what I'm sort of saying to you is that regardless if we head down this path of trying to provide low-income housing in rural areas for folks, there is going to be opposition from the same people that have opposed all kinds of opportunities in the land use system. And I guess what I'm suggesting is your organization seriously consider becoming advocates for the opportunity for folks, especially that we had with CASA up here a few minutes ago, you know, with seniors who are renting, this is a great opportunity. And I just would urge you, your organization, to pursue that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I understand what you're saying.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes.
I don't have a question for Mr. Bennett, but I just, like to put on the record that you know, this is an issue that we've dealt with in multiple bills this session, trying to solve this you know, tough decision, problem that we have, and to a large extent it's a problem that our own statutory scheme has created, because we draw lines around cities and we say, you know, inside that city or inside that boundary you get to build whatever, you know, the local zoning will allow you to build, and outside you can't do anything. And I've been involved in this legislative process for a long time, and, you know, I understand the interest groups and where they are, and I believe that we have an opportunity, whether it's the Dash 2s or a variation on the Dash 2s, whether it's something that's similar to Senate Bill 765, which I've never read or seen, or Senate Bill 187, that, again, another bill that hasn't been in any committee that I'm in, you know, we could modify the Dash 2s to more closely align to perhaps the bill that LCDC has brought to the legislature. But we can solve this problem if we allow the market to work, allow folks that have land that's maybe less valuable, that's outside the urban growth boundary, that would be suitable for a rural manufactured housing park. And, you know, we just talk about having space for these seniors and families that are being dislocated. Let's create a space for them. All we got to do is kind of break out of this mold of, well, it's outside the urban growth boundary, you can't develop out there, that's bad. It's bad. I don't know what is bad. Is it bad that we're having 80-year-old widows being turned out on the street? Is that bad? And then we create a whole bunch of new statutes and new, you know, schemes to try to fix that problem, when all we have to do is say, all right, let's take some land that's outside of an overgrowth boundary that's maybe not super productive farmland and allow for a manufactured housing park to be developed out there. I don't have, to my knowledge, in my new district, I don't believe that I've got manufactured housing parks outside of urban growth boundaries in my new district. What I used to represent, I know that I did, Senator George's district currently. These are manufactured housing parks that are out in rural settings. They've been there for years. They don't seem to conflict with the neighboring uses. It's a solution. It's a real solution. Rather than another bill that we had in another committee, it's going to raise a tax of $60 million to help to fix this problem when all we have to do is say, all right, let's break out of this problem that we have, that we've self-created, the statutorily created, and create a solution, rather than create, you know, all these other, what I would consider, Band-Aid fixes to this problem. Mr. Chair, I don't anticipate we'll move the dash 2 amendments today, but I would encourage you to work with me, Senator George, and others in this room to come up with a real solution to this problem that we keep sticking Band-Aids on. I don't want to kill House Bill 2096. I think it's a good bill, the base bill. I think it's important. I think we can move that bill forward at some point. But it does have the right relating clause, and I saw the bill come across, and I quickly went to council on Monday late to ask for an amendment, and I was gone yesterday, so I got it just a few minutes before we came. So I think it's an opportunity for us to have a discussion and create a real solution. And, yeah, it's tough. Yeah, there's interest groups that don't like any development outside of urban growth boundaries, and, oh, my goodness, it's going to be the camel nose under the tent or whatever they want to call it. But it's plain as the nose in my face that this would create a solution, create a place, so that these 80-year-old widows and other families, I mean, you got a lot of families, too, but a lot of seniors who are just at their wit's end. Because, you know, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? We can create a situation where we can provide a place for them. And they don't have the same pressures of development that they have inside an urban growth boundary. So, Mr. Chair, I'd ask that you allow us to work on this, come up with something. I know this isn't the Land Use Committee, but this bill is in front of us, and it's in our committee, and I'd ask that you allow us to work it.
Thank you, Senator. Art Schlack had asked to testify on the dash 2. Do you still want to talk? And if so, come forward.
Mr. Chair, if you're not going to move the dash 2 today, I don't need to testify.
Okay.
We just indicated that the Association of Urban Counties would be more than willing to work with Senator Starr and others to address this problem, which we recognize.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schlack. For people in TV land, the voice you heard was not God, but Art Schlack, Association of Oregon Counties. So what we'll do is, just first of all, I want to make two comments. Number one is, I do sincerely appreciate Senator Starr's efforts and always the creative thinking trying to solve problems. And again, we're all just looking at this for the first time, but I do much appreciate that. I co-authored a bill with Representative Patty Smith, which I knew I was, you know, it's always terrible when you author a bill that you know is going to be destroyed. But I did my best about citing schools in farmland because of the Hood River situation, and I thought it was important to have that discussion too. I think I was 0-7 on the committee for all various reasons, but I was expecting the arrows. But similar problems of facing about, you know, cost and providing facilities, and certainly aware of the attendant issues that brings up in terms of development pressure, in terms of sewer services and everything else. But it does show its head in a number of areas, which is one reason I think most of us are really, really hopeful that our Big Look committee will look at a lot of these types of issues in terms of how we solve some of them. So I do appreciate that. I would share the sentiment of a number of folks is I think this model, even though it doesn't provide new resources, I think that probably the model that has worked in New Hampshire to be able to try to empower those people in these parks as much as possible to find solutions is really important. And I really want that to go forward here before we are finished with our business in this committee. What I will do, we will hold for a while on that. We don't have lots of time, but I would ask that Senator Starr and Senator Starr would like to work with, provide some expertise, if you would give him your attention in short order to see if there is a creative way to help address some of this, maybe in this bill, that doesn't create serious obstacles to passage. I would ask that be done, and then, you know, kind of report back to us and see if there's you know, if our light bulb goes on here, we can provide something. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2096, and we'll be bringing it back later. Okay, let's see, where are we? Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2169. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 2169 was filed, pre-session filed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining at DCBS, and it would eliminate a current ability for a licensee to get a partial year license at OLCC for a prorated amount for paying less than the annual license fee. So it eliminates that ability. This is partially to help with online fee payments and partially to, since the issuance date is not known when a person gets their license, it's sometimes hard to figure out how much they do owe. There is a fiscal impact statement which shows a positive revenue from the positive revenue increase from this change.
Okay, thank you. Daniel McNeil.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan McNeil, and I am the Metro Licensing Unit Manager for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2169 today. This bill, as you've already heard, was submitted by the OLCC, and as a big picture look at this, this is really something that goes hand in hand with the current effort we're making to streamline our licensing processes and ultimately move to an internet-based application process for initial licenses. This biennium, we're implementing a new licensing system that will give us the ability to do our license renewals online. We hope the next biennium that we'll be able to make that next logical step, which is to be able to accept license applications over the internet for people who are applying for a brand new business. And how this helps that process out is that if this bill passes, a person would be able to go online, fill out the application, and just like they do with all their other online shopping, submit the license fee at the time that they apply for the license. Currently, they can't do that. And the reason they can't do that is that our current licenses are based, license fees for the first year of licensing are based on two things. One of them is the geographic location where the business is, and the second one is what time in the year they apply for the license. In order to help even out our liquor licensing, the current statute essentially breaks our licensing into four different quarters of the year. And essentially we've taken and designated geographic regions throughout the state, so all the licenses in each area expire at the same time, and we find that's helpful to our licensees. The issue is that because of this licensing scheme that we currently have, if somebody wants to apply for a liquor license today, I can't tell them what their fee is going to be because it really depends on when we're ready to issue that license, and there's a number of factors that go into when we're ready to issue that, including the fact that we have to get a recommendation from the local government, and they have up to 45 days, but there's no mandated time period below that in which they can make a recommendation to us. And we also have things that we have to take into consideration, such as public testimony about the license application, or if there's issues involving the license, the person's licensability under our statutes. So by eliminating the prorated fee that we're currently dealing with, we'd be able to accept the fee at the time they apply for the license, as soon as we're ready to either issue them a temporary authority to operate if they qualify for that, or a liquor license, we can just issue that without having to go through a second step of contacting the person, having them come in and pay a fee, and then getting on with their licensed businesses. In some cases, it's a fairly inconvenient thing. And a number of our licensees, small business owners, actually at the point where they're the only person at the business, we call them up and say, we're ready to issue a license to you. They have to physically close their business down, drive into our office, and pay a fee in order to get the license to allow them to go into business. And so we're trying to provide some convenience for applicants, too. The upshot of this is it will cost some of the applicants more money in the first year that they get licensed because the fee won't be prorated. We believe that the benefit they get through the ease of applying all in one step over the internet and the not having the inconvenience of having to stop what they're doing to come get their license would offset that change in fees. Again, we request that you support this bill, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
Mr. McGill, what is the license fee, the annual license fee?
The license fee depends on the type of license, okay. And our fees are actually very reasonable compared to most other states for liquor licenses. The low end of our license fees, it's $100 a year, and that's for a license that you'd have at a Safeway store, a convenience store, a mom-and-pop market. The licenses that are beer and wine licenses that a lot of restaurants have are $200 a year. The full on-premises sales license, which is your beer, wine, and distilled spirits, so you'd have like a restaurant and a lounge, that's $400 a year. And on the highest end is the brewery license, which is $500 a year.
Okay. And I know that, colleagues, we're going to have a couple more bills along these lines, OLCC, in terms of licensing, and that will be before us. So, but I wanted to get these starting to move and be heard. Senator Starr.
Why don't you license these folks at the point that they apply rather than have everybody's licenses expire at the same time? It seems like you could go online and pay your license, and it's good for the year from the date that they write the check or you do the processing, and then it's good for a year and everybody's fine.
We had looked at that, and we weren't proposing changes to the current language. It says that licenses are valid, you know, through these four quarters. I think if you went to that type of system, ultimately there would be some evening out, but we do have a large number of licenses that are in the Portland metro area. Generally, we find that we have big, essentially, licensing periods that happen in the spring and toward the beginning of the fall, and that's where the majority of our business comes in. Over time, we'd see that our licensing would essentially have two really large bubbles, periods where all the licenses expire. And some of the advantages that we get with the current licensing system is that everybody in the same area has their license expire at the same time. And believe it or not, business people who are taking care of business at their restaurant, store, or tavern often don't pay attention to things like license expiration dates. So it's real helpful for all the businesses. They're talking to their friends and their competition to know that, oh, yes, our licenses all expire. In this area, we all expire on October 1st. It's also helpful for the wholesalers who make deliveries and are required to check to see if there's a current license there, that they know it's October, I need to go out and check these licenses in this area. So there are some advantages to having licenses that expire at the same time. Probably the biggest is just helping to even out the workload, though.
Have you, have you had outreach with your licensees about this proposal? I mean, had a discussion about it with them?
We had an open house where we presented and had the opportunity for licensees and other interested parties to come, and we put forward a number of the recommendations that we made and had a chance for them to talk about those and view those. I haven't gotten any negative feedback over this idea, so we've had it out there and available, but haven't gotten any negative comments. I think mostly because it only affects a person during their first year of licensing. It's not something that will continue through and increase their costs over the term of their license, but just for that first initial year.
Other questions? Okay. Mr. McGill is about to want to testify on this. How do we feel about this bill? We're only three of us.
My office and my reservation is that it hits people who, in their first year of operation, which is always when you're strapped for cash, you're trying to start up a new restaurant or whatever, strapped for cash. I'll more than willing to give a courtesy vote to the floor if you want to move this bill. To me, it bothers me that it's the first year that people are first applying. I'd rather it be later on, you know, that they get hit once they're making money. So, but I guess that's where I'm kind of coming down. I understand the reason for, by the way, I understand the reason for the efficiency, and I think that's great. I just...
Yeah, I'm not. So you have four regions. So the four regions are coming every quarter. Then, so that's, and the regions apparently have quasi equal number of licensees in each.
Yes, we try to balance
that. Or that keeps your workload to a similar level throughout the year.
Right.
So you're afraid that if you go to a situation where, you know, their license is renewed upon when they come into the system, that that somehow you're going to have too many of these peaks and valleys?
Yeah, at some point we'll have a couple of really big peaks in our licensing. It would be less spread out over the course of the year than we have now.
So the issue is that not in this business, but more restaurants or bars or whatever are started in summer or fall?
We tend to see a big increase usually in the springtime. The businesses, the winter right after the first of the year is pretty slow time. I mean, that's the time when restaurant sales are down. You know, people have gone through the holidays, they spent their money, and we see a fall off in our license application, pretty substantial. Summertime is really when we see a big pickup in the business, and that's when we tend to see a lot of license applications is in the spring in anticipation of the summer, and then toward the end of the summer we also see an uptick in the license applications kind of up toward the holiday period where there's again a lot of business going on. So
yeah, well, I know a lot of other licensing agencies, you do their licensing based on, you know, the application and approval and rather than a set time every year, and in that case it's because they don't want all the licenses come due at the same time, where then they do have this huge mountain of work to do. But if that's not the case with your particular licensees, then...
Well, and one of the things that we do have, too, currently by statute, is that we do have to notify local governments and give them a 60-day period to make comments on renewing licenses. What the current system does, which helps out the local governments as well, is that they get a list of everybody that's expiring. And so they know once a year that they can review that, and they're not having to put this on their council agenda on a recurring basis throughout the year, too. So there is some, I think... Some thought in there that, you know, this does continue to make this a process that is easier, at least for the local governments
as
well.
I'm okay with it.
Okay, Sir George.
Yeah, how does this affect temporary licenses? Or, I mean, sometimes they're short term. Do they pay for the full year?
A person who has a temporary license, how they currently work is that it's prorated like the other ones. Now, the people that qualify for a temporary license are really people who are either buying an existing business that has a liquor license or starting up a new off-premises sales license like a grocery store or convenience store. And they actually pay essentially based on the date that temporary license gets issued is the date that then they pay through the end of that licensing year. So it's a prorated fee based on the date that's issued through the end of the licensing year.
Does this affect that?
This would not affect that. Well, it would in that everybody would just pay the fee, and if you wanted a temporary license and qualified, you'd have paid the fee, and you'd get that temporary license as well.
Okay. All righty. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing and open work session on House Bill 2169. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2169 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Appreciate your vote. Senator George, please mark... if there's no other objections, mark Senator Deckert and Lana Sanderson is excused. Passes, and I'll carry the bill. Okay. Next, let's open up public hearing on House Bill 2074. Janet.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2074 is the first of three bills on the agenda today that were filed, pre-session filed for the State Landscape Contractors Board. House Bill 2074 establishes that a landscaping business license applicant has to have at least one owner or managing employee that's licensed as a landscape contractor, and that the owner or managing employee must show proof to the Landscape Contractors Board that they've completed required courses and passed an exam related to the courses. It allows the board to establish the required courses by rule and approve courses by other examiners. Mr. Chair, Mike Snyder's here to go through the other details about the bill. It would apply to landscaping businesses. Business licenses that are issued on or after January 1st, 2009, so it's has a delayed effective date.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Snyder. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Metzger and member of the committee, My name for the record is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. I do need to make a correction to Janet's summary of the bill. This bill does not require a landscaping business to have an owner or managing employee be licensed. What we're after here is for any landscaping business that does not have a licensed landscape contractor, that's the individual that has taken the competency exam. If that person that wants to start a landscaping business does not have that individual license, then that business has to either have an owner or a designated managing employee, somebody that works just for that business, to have taken a class of no more than 16 hours of instruction and passed an examination that demonstrates they understand what it is to run a landscaping business in the state of Oregon. So that's not a license that we're giving to that person. We're just making that a requirement for anybody that doesn't have the individual license, that if they're going to start a business, then they have to demonstrate what it is to run a landscaping business, to follow the strict contract laws that we have. We have one of the strictest contract laws in the state of Oregon. It's all landscaping work within the state of Oregon, whether it's 10 cents or $10 million, has to be done by a written contract. They have to follow all the laws regarding employment, making sure that those people that are doing the landscape work are employed by the business. They're not 1099ing them or making them independent contractors. And so these types of things are occurring with businesses out there today, and we are seeing a need to make sure that those people that want to start a business, that want to invest in a business, understand the fiscal responsibilities that are associated with the landscaping business. That's what this bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Questions for Mr. Snyder? Sarah George.
I guess it gets back to the issue that we had the other day. I'm trying to figure out, if somebody's mowing my lawn, what problem are we trying to solve? I don't get the sense that there is an immense amount of anger out there among people who hire landscape maintenance people. I don't sense that there's this huge outrage that we got to change these laws and make them more cumbersome.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, this is not regarding landscape maintenance.
Okay.
Landscape maintenance in the state of Oregon is not regulated.
Okay.
This is talking about landscape construction work.
Okay.
Which is talking, you know, since our legislation or our statute started back in 1973, landscape work within the state of Oregon has changed significantly. I mean, you can look at some of the landscape projects, construction projects that are done today are million-dollar projects. And so we only regulate the landscape construction industry, which is defined as the planning and installing of lawns, trees, shrubs, and nursery stock, the installation of irrigation systems. We're not talking about the person that provides the landscape maintenance.
Really, the discussion I'm talking about, landscape maintenance, is not covered by this bill.
That is correct.
Okay, that's all I want to make sure.
So we are, you know, this industry, landscape construction industry, chose to be regulated, and we have. And these other bills that we're talking about today also addressing some of these issues that we have with the landscaping business, with the two-license system that we have in place today, that we have allowed owners of landscaping businesses, even if they don't know anything about landscape construction or anything about the laws that deal with landscape construction, can start these businesses by hiring an individual that's taken the test. And they put that person in the field, or that person sometimes is sitting behind a desk someplace and not even supervising the work that's being done. They don't have any fiscal responsibility with the business. So this owner doesn't have any clue of what's going on in the business in terms of what they have to do for written contracts, what they have to do and follow the laws of the employment laws. And so we would like these people, they're going to start a landscaping business, to understand what it is that they're getting themselves into and the laws that they have to follow.
Chair?
Yeah.
I think I'm being dense here because it's late in the afternoon, but
So
you're talking about there can be landscape contracting businesses that do not have a landscape contractor certification in them? I mean, how do they do that? How do they construct that work?
Chair Metzger, Senator George. Let me, and I'll take the time to do this because I think the other bills that we're going to be talking about are probably going to even deal more with this, and I would like to have you have a clear understanding, and I'll do the best I can. And
so appreciate that.
Please come back at me with anything you want because it is confusing. It's one of the things that this current law has in it that's relatively confusing. Currently, the law says that if you want to start a landscape construction business, I'm going to call it a landscape construction business so you don't confuse it with maintenance.
Okay.
Landscape construction business, you have to have a licensed individual who they call a landscape contractor, an individual landscape contractor in the current statutes. That's a individual person. Be employed, or you have to be the owner of the business. That individual has to be the owner of the business. That individual needs to supervise all unlicensed employees of that business and is supposed to supervise all the landscape activities of the business. That means an owner of a business, if say Senator Starr wanted to start a landscaping business, he could do that by hiring you, if you had the individual landscape contractor's license, to supervise the landscape work. Well, what does that mean? We've defined supervision to be readily available to those that are performing the work. Doesn't mean you have any fiscal responsibility in the business. Doesn't mean you take any responsibility for the business. You're just trying to assure that there is, or promote that there is, some consistency and some good work being done in the field. Now, Senator Starr, being the owner, may or may not know anything about landscape contracting. And he may not know that he has to have a written contract for the work that you're performing. And if he doesn't have a written contract, he cannot execute that contract in a court of law. And he wouldn't have to even get paid. Likewise, he may think, well, you know, you're my friend, I'll just pay you cash. That just made you violate the law, subject to a $1,000 fine. Or I'm going to 1099 you because I don't really want to pay the employment tax. Those types of things come up because they don't understand the relationship that needs to exist, and they inadvertently make their employees subject to civil penalty. And it's the employees that aren't licensed are the ones that suffer the burden of that because they either weren't employed properly, subject to fines, and that owner didn't understand that when they got into that business. It's very similar to the Construction Contractors Board, what they do right now. They do what they call an RMI. They have a responsible managing individual that takes that exam, takes the class, takes the exam, demonstrates they know some knowledge about liens and contracts and employment law, everything that's associated around running a business for a construction business. That is what we're after here for our people. Does that clarify that for you?
Yeah. In essence, what you're saying is that under the relationship you were talking about, Senator Starr, as the owner, would have to go to 16 hours of classes per year to make sure he's aware of how the business operates under the license.
Or designate. Or he could say to you,
yeah.
If you weren't licensed, designate you as a managing employee, that you could only work for his business, only one business,
gotcha.
And you would be fiscally responsible for the decision of that business.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm being so dense.
No,
I
appreciate,
really
appreciate,
appreciate you. I appreciate you walking me through that relationship.
It is confusing. I would really like to have you understand it because it is confusing to lots of people.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Close public hearing on House Bill 2074 and open work session.
Mr. Chairman, the bill, House Bill 2074 is held.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2074 to the floor with a due pass. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Please mark Senator Deckard and Miles Harrison as excused. Who would like to carry this bill? That's what I figured. All right. I will carry the bill. Okay. You might as well stay right where you are. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2075. Janet.
Mr. Chair, the House Bill 2075 are technical changes, and I think it might as well just have Snyder go through.
That's a nice way to punt.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Snyder, again. Please state your name again for the record.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. Thank you again for taking time to hear this bill. House Bill 2075 is basically a housekeeping bill, and for the benefit of Sarah DeGeorge, this confusion is prevalent throughout the statutes. We have things in our statute today that, number one, talks about registration instead of licensing. It says that it should be registered by the Landscape Contractor Board. Our board's a licensing board. We want to correct that language. They have the word landscape contractor. Somebody needs to be employed by a landscape contractor. This is what's important about this. A landscape contractor is an individual. That individual does not employ. It's the business that employs employees. So it's the business that carries the bonding and insurance and workers' comp. It is not the individual. The individual has no fiscal responsibility at all. This, we also had, you know, as I was talking to you about how you form a business, you have to either own or employ a license, be a licensed landscape contractor or employ a licensed landscape contractor to form that business. The statute says that you had to employ a licensed landscape contractor. Sole proprietors don't employ themselves. So we didn't have that provision in there. It says let an owner be the licensed landscape contractor. So we're correcting that language to make it correct throughout the statutes. So that's what this bill does. It's a housekeeping bill.
Okay. Questions, Mr. Snyder? Okay. You okay with this? Okay. We'll stop here and open a work session on House Bill 2075.
I move House Bill 2075 to the Senate floor for due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2075 to the floor for due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Mark Senator Deckard and Monty Sanders are excused, and I won't ask. I'll carry this bill.
I'm more than willing to carry this one. It's easy.
Oh!
Okay. I don't care.
All right, Senator George will carry the bill. No, I wish I will carry it.
Whatever you want.
I'll carry it. We'll put them together that way. So.
You have your take-home bill, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2017, Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2117 is going to change the terminology for both the landscape, both types of licensing, so that the business has a different, licensing of the business has a different terminology because the landscape contractor under current law is not actually the person doing the contracting unless it's a sole proprietor. So it goes through, that's why it's so big, it goes through all the statutes and makes new terms for those two types of licenses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Snyder.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Mike Snyder and I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. House Bill 2117. For years, we have been struggling with the term landscape contractor referring to an individual. It all started back in 1979 when they changed the board name from for hire advisory, for hire landscaper, a for hire landscaper board to a landscape contractors board. Back then, most of the businesses and most of the individuals that were licensed were individuals and became sole proprietors. And the term landscape contractor has stuck in the statutes for a long time, and a lot of people feel that landscape contractors are people that contract. It is not true. It is the landscaping business that enters into contracts and does the contracting. It is more confusing because we were with the Construction Contractors Board for so many years, and they use the term general contractor, and people don't quite realize that that is only for business also. So an individual goes out and calls himself a general contractor, they can do that because it is the business that is the licensed entity in the construction contracting field. We have a two-license system, which creates this problem for us. So we have attempted to work with the Landscape Contractors Association and with the landscape architects. We talked to quite a few people about it. I became aware of today that the landscape designers are not pleased with this language and would like to testify on this, and I'm willing to hear that testimony. But what I would like to impress upon you is that it took me a long time to work with the Landscape Contract Association and the members of that to get the word contractor out and use the word professional, because there's a big ego thing around I am a contractor. And to have them change to something else was a pretty big step on our part. And they have finally agreed to it and are willing to allow that term landscape professional, identify them, since they are people that have taken a competency exam and demonstrated their ability to perform this work. So we are faced with some opposition today that I wasn't aware was going to be here. And there's no prohibition to these people calling themselves professional landscape designers or professional landscape maintenance people or anything like that. We're just restricting the word professional, landscape professional. And we've already restricted the term landscape in a previous session. That can't be used. That term landscape cannot be used unless it's used by some other, followed by some other term that indicates the nature of their business or design nature of their business. So that's what this bill does. Also, there's a big section in this bill that legislative council took liberty to move out of ORS 701, which is construction contractors law, and move it into our own law so that we mirror what they have for the metro licensing section.
Okay. Yeah, it's at the end. Okay.
It's at the end.
Thank you, Snyder. Well, why don't you go ahead and step back. We've got a trio of people came together, so we'll just have them all come up at once. See what they don't like about this. So we're all landscape designer folks, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Whoever. Okay. Please do.
Chairman Metzger, committee members, my name is Amy Whitworth. I consider myself to be one of a community of landscape professionals with a specialty of landscape design. I serve as a legislative advocate for the Association of Professional Landscape Designers. We're an international organization dedicated to maintaining excellence in standards of practice for the professional landscape design field. We have an Oregon chapter of the APLD, which is statewide throughout Oregon, started in 2003. APLD Oregon is opposed to the Bill 2117, particularly the change in term from landscape contractor to landscape professional. We're not opposed to the change in term from landscape business to landscape contracting business that further explains the landscaping business. We are opposed to the change in term landscape professional because we don't think it's any clearer for the public. Landscape professionals would prohibit, landscape professionals encompass a large group of people from landscape designers, landscape architects, nursery people, growers, landscape maintenance people. There's a very large group of people that considers themselves now to be landscape professionals. This would now prohibit all of those other groups of people from calling themselves landscape professionals. Previously, APLD did submit to the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board a letter during the proposed legislation stating our objection to this term with a description of why. In talking with Mike Snyder earlier today, we discussed the possibility of using a term licensed landscape professional, which we would feel comfortable with because it further describes the nature of that type of landscape professional. We're concerned that by claiming the title of landscape professional for the people who are now known as landscape contractors, things like a website with a category of landscape professionals that might include ourselves, landscape contractors, growers, other people within the green industry, that would no longer be a title that would be appropriate to use. So that would only mean landscape contractors, and that just doesn't feel right to us. There's an example that I just learned about recently where a plant broker who markets herself to landscape professionals. That's in her advertising. She supplies plants to landscape professionals like landscape architects, landscape designers, and grower nurseries. She would now no longer be able to say that's true. That would mean that she's only marketing to landscape contractors, those who install landscapes. As far as the two-license system goes, I think that this wouldn't really help solve that particular problem. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to present that testimony.
Okay. We are getting short in our committee time, so we'll go to the next witness, but give us something new or just say amen to our first set of comments, please.
My name is Paul Taylor. I'm the president of the Association of Northwest Landscape Designers. We're a group of 25. Our organization is 25 years old. We have over 100 members. Most of us feel exactly the way she's talking about, that a landscape professional is a number of people, not just what a contractor is. I've always considered myself to be a landscape professional. It's just a very large, encompassing term that the green industry uses. It concerns designers that the ability to refer ourselves to landscape professionals would be unfairly compromised with the introduction of this legislation. I feel like I'm a member of the landscape professional community without being a contractor, and nor do I want to take on those responsibilities of a contractor. I would hire or have my client hire a contractor. I don't want to be that person. I don't think I'm able to do that job. I don't want to do that job. I'm only a designer. That's what I want to be.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
All right, thanks.
Senator Metzger, and committee, my name is Barbara Hilty. I'm a landscape designer. I'm also president of the Association of Professional Landscape Designers at Oregon Chapter. To paraphrase everything, APLD is very supportive of the goals and work of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board. They've done an excellent job, and we understand what they're trying to clarify, but we believe that this change to landscape professional is confusing the matter more, and it's limiting other landscape professionals. As Amy said, we are landscape designers. We consider ourselves part of the landscape professional world, working in collaboration with arborists, landscape contractors, landscape architects, et cetera, all landscape professionals. But to kind of give you an analogy, the term landscape professional is sort of like saying medical professional. A medical professional includes anesthesiologists, surgeons, nurse practitioners, all kinds of people. And this would be like nurse practitioners deciding to call themselves medical professionals. And no one else in the medical profession could call themselves that. And we think that is confusing. And so as president of the Oregon chapter of APLD, I support our discussion we had with Mike Snyder earlier this afternoon to change the term to licensed landscape professional, because we know he's gone through a lot of reiterations in trying to solve this problem, and we're trying to work together to solve that. And I want to thank you for listening to us, and if you have any questions.
Thank you. We will ask Mr. Snyder back up in a second. Questions for these folks? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Snyder, would you come back forward? So I'll have you re-identify yourself for the record, but I think you've heard the discussion, and so I'd like to have your feedback on that and your thoughts.
Chair Metzger, for the record, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. I can't speak for the board at this point, nor can I speak for Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, or can I speak for the landscape architects. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that we work directly with, and I guess I would appeal to you to let me go back to them and mention this to them and see what they have to say. I think from my perspective, personal perspective, licensed landscape professional is indicated just because of the term we're asking them to be licensed. So it doesn't really change the term very substantially. And it's just adding the word licensed, and we're after people that are going to be landscape professionals to be licensed. So I don't really have an objection to that term. I don't know for sure what it's going to accomplish, but we'd sure be willing to discuss that.
You can probably answer this. If not, I'll ask one of them back up. But are landscape designers licensed? Is there any licensing for these folks?
There's no licensing for landscape designers.
Okay. Well, before I make a comment, anybody have a comment or question? What I think I'll do is we'll give a shot at this. It's not something I'm going to spend a lot of time on. If you, Mr. Snyder, will speak and work with Mr. Taylor and Ms. Whitworth or Barbara in the next few days and see if there is an accommodation that not only can be worked on but would be appropriate, and to see what feedback you would get from the other groups. And get back to Janet about whether there is something that can be done on that. We will give an opportunity to do that, and then we'll hear back, and we'll kind of make a decision at that point. How's that?
Yeah, what would be my deadline on that?
Well, we've only got 2 weeks left. We'll either move the bill the way it is or whatever, but I would prefer that you have a chance to talk to these folks and see if there's something. I mean, I don't think there's not like, 6 degrees of separation here. I mean, I think it's like 2 degrees. I mean, you came up with something that made sense. I understand their point. Obviously, it wasn't trying to be combative. It just kind of happened. So I think there's something that probably could be done here that makes the distinction that you want. But I'll ask that you guys take an effort to make sure you contact each other and then keep in contact with Janet. I'd like to know by the very first of the next week, what we've come up with or not. How's that?
I have a board meeting on Friday, so that'd be good.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2117. Let's see. Senator Deckard and Senator Monis Anderson. What did we move? We moved the 2169, 2074, and 2075. Would you like to vote on those bills? It's up to you. But happy to do that, Senator Monis Anderson. Okay. Is there any objection to suspending the rules so that Senator Monis Anderson and Senator Deckard can vote? Okay. If not, so ordered. Senator Deckard, how do you vote on House Bill 2169?
I'm going to vote aye. Can I do them all?
Yes, and House Bill 2074?
Aye.
And House Bill 2075. Hold on there. House Bill 2075.
Now.
No, okay. Senator Monitz Anderson, how would you like to vote on House Bill 2169?
2169, aye.
House Bill 2074.
2074, aye.
And House Bill 2075.
And House Bill 2075 is the...
What's going on in here?
Aye.
All right, please record them.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and
can
Senator,
I, vote?
I had a funny feeling. Senator George would like unanimous permission to change his vote on House Bill, what one was it?
2169.
2169. Any objection? No objection. Senator George, how do you vote?
No.
Don't know, will not change the outcome, so please change Senator George. Thank you for your courtesy vote and your willingness to do that, but he's now officially no on 2169, and we are here.